Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, we'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, we'll bring you key stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, hunger fears mount as a chicken import ban disrupts our food supply. Syndicates stalking women in malls as the SAPS faces more pressure to respond. Remote work is fueling a rise in cyber threats as an expert warns of AI-driven risk. And the private sector fills potholes while government delivery falls short. It's Monday, the 2nd of June. Now, could it be that South Africa is currently sleepwalking into a food crisis? A government-imposed ban on chicken imports from Brazil, the country's biggest supplier, could potentially leave millions without access to affordable protein, and the stakes are staggering. Something in the region of 400 million meals a month, thousands of jobs, and the survival of school feeding schemes. So the question, I guess, is the Department of Agriculture putting health protocols above hunger relief, or is this a policy failure with potentially devastating consequences? Someone who's waded into that debate is George Southey, manager Murlog Foods. It's a Durban-based supplier of frozen chickens. George, a very warm welcome to you. Brazil is central to South Africa's food supply chain. You've identified this as a crisis. Just how big is it?
In my opinion and our opinion as a business, it is huge. Just to give you an idea, South Africa imports substantial volumes, probably just short of 500,000 tons a year of total protein, animal protein from Brazil, of which a substantial portion of that is chicken. And if we don't replace in a very quick way the lost supply, there could be a severe crisis on our hands.
How close are we to that right now? Are we going to see or are we seeing protein shortages in retail stores already?
I think we're in the process of seeing that it's about to become a reality. So just to give an understanding and an idea, the supply chains from Brazil to South Africa generally would take about 4 weeks from time of shipment to time of product being available to go into the food chain in South Africa. As you've mentioned now, there's a substantial volume that does come into the country every month, but bans from shipments after the 16th of May have already come into place. So effectively, there have already been 2 weeks of no shipments, and every additional week that we delay is another 100 million meals in effect that will be lost to our consumers.
And local producers cannot fill this gap in supply, can they?
No, they definitely can't. I think the local industry has already indicated that they can bring another million chickens a week into the food chain. But those eggs have to be hatched. The chickens need to be grown, and that product then needs to go through an abattoir and through the supply chain to land on the consumer's shelf or the retailer's shelves. So those chickens, assuming they can be brought on stream quite quickly, probably won't see the retail shelves for at least 8 to 12 weeks. So that's 2 to 3 months. So even though it will be appreciated, it'll be good for the local poultry industry, it's going to take a while to reach the shelves. But more importantly, a million birds a week is maybe around about 10 million meals a week. So that's 40 million meals a week. That doesn't replace the 40 million meals a month. That doesn't replace the 400 million meals that we lose because of the raw material supply, and in particular of mechanically deboned meat, which is a raw material in making polonies and sausages.
And you're particularly concerned about the implications for school feeding schemes.
Yes, the only animal protein that's on the South African School Feeding Scheme program is chicken livers. Now, South Africa obviously produces a liver with every chicken, but a liver is a fairly small part of it, and that supply is supplemented through imported livers. So that product will now also be lost to the country, which will effectively mean shortages, it'll mean price increases, and we can talk about price increases in a moment. But there's also then a lot of, let's call it the cold meats, polonies, which are put on a slice of bread for school lunches, a Vienna or a Russian sausage, which may land up being sold at the school gates by a vendor and so on. And those products are about to disappear from the consumer basket.
Let's get to price in just a moment, but what would your response be to critics who say public health must come first?
Well, chicken is HPAI or avian influenza, is not a public health crisis. It's more an animal health crisis. And yes, we have to protect our, let's say, animal disease status and not import bird flu into our national flock, because that would cause an even bigger crisis. And we have had and seen the impacts of that in 2017 and again, I think, in 2023 with local outbreaks of avian influenza. But I think that if we look at it, there are very strong codes through the World Organization of Animal Health relating to avian influenza and many other animal diseases. And there are ways to, let's say, protect the animal disease status of our own flock while still allowing for imports. One of the main processes that's used globally is regionalization or zoning, and that option is available. South Africa's taken a very conservative view in terms of how they would apply zoning, but many other countries that are dependent on food imports around the world, such as Mexico, Japan, Cuba, Middle East, UAE, etc., which is Dubai, they've all already relaxed their requirements and their restrictions, from country restrictions down to regions which are infected that will be banned. But from the balance of the country, they will still bring in the much needed food sources, because Brazil is such an important supplier to the world of chicken.
At what point, or are we already starting to see that price spike that you referenced?
We're already seeing the price spike out of fear and panic at a wholesale level. We've already seen that in particular meat processors and certain retailers have tried to take any surplus product out of the market, and they've already paid, and we've seen that prices already on some of the imported chicken products have dramatically increased. Local chicken producers also have had an increased demand, and none of them are sitting with stocks in cold stores at the moment. And that product will be used up very quickly, especially from the middle of June, when any product that may have been on the water stops coming in from Brazil. So we've already seen prices increase substantially. And then alternative sources of animal protein, such as pork and beef, there's also been increased demand, and that wholesalers and processors again have taken trimmings and other cuts out of the market, and those prices have also increased. So we already are seeing that at the wholesale level, and I'm sure that'll feed through to the retail level in a very quick time.
George Sarvi, thank you very much indeed, manager at Murlog Foods. I do appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
All right, let's move now from agribusiness to crime. And it seems a disturbing pattern is starting to emerge in South African shopping malls. Organized criminal syndicates are targeting women with increasing precision and violence. Victims apparently followed, ambushed and robbed in broad daylight. Obviously, this is raising urgent questions about personal safety, surveillance blind spots and police preparedness. My question, are malls now becoming a new hunting ground for syndicates, and are law enforcement agencies one step behind or one step ahead? I'm in conversation now with Brigadier Athlende Mate, who speaks for the South African Police Service. Brigadier, a very warm welcome to you, and maybe just a few more details on the nature and method of these new syndicate operations. What's happening?
So I don't think we need to panic, because I'm confident that we have broken the back of a syndicate that was targeting women, especially young females, in various malls across the country. So it looks like we were dealing with a two-member syndicate. But as you would have known from last week, one of them was shot and killed during a police takedown operation in Amanzimtoti in Durban. And one is still on the run. But police are searching for this particular suspect, Bongani Mthimkhulu, and we have urged him to hand himself over. So the discovery of this particular, or the identification of this particular syndicate, was made last week following the death of Olerato Mongale, who was killed, brutally killed yesterday after going out on a date with this particular syndicate. So what they do, they go around malls and proposing women and requesting to take them out on dates, whereas they know the real motive there is actually to kidnap and rob them. So far we've actually picked up more than, I think now we're standing at 24 cases, in KZN, Durban, in Potchefstroom, in Midrand, in Bloemfontein, in Limpopo, as well as in Mpumalanga, where these two suspects, criminals rather, had been operating in. So a lot of women coming forward with information, where they've positively identified the one deceased, Phelakeng Nkosi Makhanya, and the other, Bongani Mthimkhulu, who has been on the run, from police.
Brigadier, as a result of this, have you been forced to increase visible police patrols in high-risk zones?
So we conduct regular patrols on a weekly basis. You'd know that in malls, the primary security primary focus there is to ensure that security officials secure malls and so on. So we come in as secondary, and we work together with them to ensure the safety and security of shoppers at malls. But primary function of the safety and security of people at malls and shoppers is private security. But we work alongside closely with them, where if they detect anything suspicious, they must bring it to our attention. So in terms of visibility, we are working at increasing visibility everywhere, not only at malls or anything, because at malls there's already private security that we are working closely on. So in terms of hotspot areas, we are working with your CPFs, your community patrollers, in terms of the sharing of information, and that is why we always say community participation is quite important in the fight against crime, because we depend on community members to be eyewitnesses when crimes are committed.
I understand the importance of collaboration between yourselves and private mall security companies, but the danger always is, given your resource capacity, you could abrogate responsibility to these companies.
Fighting crime is not the sole responsibility of the police. And that is why when we talk resources, we don't work alone. We work with private security, we work with community members, we work with other government departments. We're also working with law enforcement agencies. And what one thing we always stress out is that, yes, we've got the expertise, we can find these people, but we rely on the community. We also rely on private security, that plays a major role as our eyes and ears. So it's not that we abdicate responsibility. We work together as a team, because when you see in court, when we've arrested a suspect, the people that come in as witnesses are community members. And that is why we say everyone has a role to play when it comes to fighting crime. And when you look at the stats, when the Minister of Correctional Services says prisons are over 40% full, those people did not walk in there. We are the ones that put them in there because of the work of the men and women in blue in terms of arrests and so on. And when you look at the stats since the 8th of May 2023, more than 1.2 million suspects arrested for various crimes. And we've also been able to secure lengthy convictions for perpetrators of various crimes, including your GBVF and so on.
As far as this particular issue is concerned, are you still issuing a broader public safety alert, or do you believe that you've nailed the problem now?
Look, we are still, obviously urging people out there, whether women, children, or male, to be extra vigilant of their surroundings. Crime, it can happen anyway, so we must be extra vigilant. Where we say criminals are in minority, but law-abiding citizens are in majority. So if we stand together, collectively, together with the police, we can do so much more because these criminals are in minority and we must ensure that they get tracked down and they get arrested for crimes committed. So it really, it takes a collective responsibility to prevent and combat all forms of criminality.
Just very quickly, can you assure women that it is safe to enter hotspot malls right now, given what has been happening there in the past?
So there's not necessarily a hotspot mall. They would actually randomly choose any other mall and start targeting victims. So we can call it a romance scam. They were busy pretending to love and like these women, whereas they know they would just kidnap and rob them. So we want to urge you also, if you've been a victim of this particular syndicate, do come forward, or you know of criminals that are busy with this type of criminality, do come forward. Let us work together. Let us put a stop, because we cannot continue to see innocent women, children, males being robbed from shopping malls, being followed, being hijacked, and so on.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Brigadier Atlende Mate, who speaks for the South African Police Service.
Remember when you had to hurry up and wait, and cars could only run on fossil fuels? Well, hurry up and catch up. You don't need diesel power. You just need a second electric motor. With Volvo plug-in hybrids, you can drive electric in the city, switch to fuel for the long haul, or combine both when you want it all. So what are you waiting for? You're late for your test drive. It's safe to be brave with Volvo.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, I don't need to tell you these days that the office is everywhere, and so are the risks. With remote and hybrid work firmly entrenched, South African businesses, it seems, are facing growing exposure to cybercrime, from AI-driven phishing to weak endpoints. The security threats are multiplying, and I want to explore that in a little more detail today. I'm in conversation with globally recognized expert Tony Anscombe, who warns that businesses may be wide open to attack. So here's my question. What are the real risks, and are South African companies doing enough to close the so-called digital door? What makes hybrid and remote work environments so vulnerable right now to cyber threats? Tony, a very warm welcome to you, and let's wade straight in. Do you think that South African companies are underestimating the severity of the risks that you've identified?
No, I think most businesses understand the threat from cybercrime or nation-state attacks is significant. It's about understanding where the line in the sand is for each business. Have they understood where their acceptable risk is and what their business could possibly deal with should an incident happen?
So strategically then, how does an organization go about defining that line in the sand?
Well, today I think it's different. I think if historically we've always seen this as a cybersecurity or IT issue, I think it's first becoming actually a financial and business resilience issue. Can the business survive a cyber incident? Can it continue to operate during a cyber incident? And what's its position financially should it have a cyber incident? I mean, we see lots of different companies, when they have an incident, you know, they then report losses afterwards, and those can stretch into the hundreds of millions depending on the size of the company. But even for a small business, you know, you could be looking at a couple of hundred thousand dollars if they had a significant cyber incident. So you need to be prepared for that.
And all of this, of course, is exacerbated these days by AI-powered attacks, which is obviously changing the cybersecurity landscape, I guess, for the worst.
It is. It's less about AI-powered attacks. They're more AI-assisted. Cybercriminals are using AI tools to help them generate their malware and their campaigns. And we see that in the likes of phishing, and in the attacks that end up in our inbox, or the social engineering pieces that try and trick us. As of yet, I think there's very limited or very few or virtually no actual AI-powered attacks, i.e. where AI is doing the attacking and AI is in control.
Where do you think right now, Tony, the weakest link is in most companies' security architecture or posture?
Well, unfortunately, that's the same globally. It's always in human behavior. It's the biggest risk any company or organization has, because human behavior might make us click on something. We can be duped. Call to a help desk asking for a password reset that sounds familiar. You know, maybe the cyber criminal's using deepfake audio to sound like somebody else. The social engineering element and human behavior is always the biggest risk any company has.
And to that end, I would imagine that at the C-suite level, there might be a lag in cyber awareness right now, and critical that any kind of directive these days for organizations is coming from the top.
It is important that cybersecurity posture comes from the top, and we see that C-suite people are taking cybersecurity very seriously. The good thing about that is, you know, regulation and legislation, fines and such like, you know, that business risk, that financial risk, is making it a boardroom topic, and therefore that C-suite should be really switched on to actually making the right decisions and the right judgments on what cybersecurity is required. But it's a challenge as well. You know, in some organizations, you've got a few thousand employees, you know, take them off and give them cybersecurity awareness training and do it continually. Most companies do it once a year. I recommend doing it probably every 3 or 4 months or in some form. You know, those things are important. And you know, that has to come from the top down.
It's not only important, it's critical, I would imagine, to the survival of any organization these days. I wonder whether cybersecurity compliance should be mandatory across all sectors.
Well, you already have some cybersecurity compliance that is mandatory. You have privacy legislation. I mean, here in South Africa, there's privacy legislation. So that makes it, if you're dealing with personal sensitive data, that makes some elements compulsory. If a business has business disruption insurance, it probably has some level of cybersecurity in that business disruption insurance. Or if they have cyber insurance, so actually insuring against the cyber attack and the cost of one, then definitely that the insurer will be forcing cybersecurity onto that agenda as well.
And Tony, just a final one. I mentioned at the start of our conversation that the paradigm has changed because of so much remote work that happens these days. In that respect, what kind of advice would you give to small or medium-sized businesses to make sure that that particular risk is mitigated?
Well, you know, we still see companies out there with, this is going to sound technical, open RDP. Now, that's kind of a method of remote access, and it needs to be really well secured. So if you are running remote workers, make sure that you have put encryption in, that you are verifying every interaction that the remote worker has, i.e. so don't trust anything. So that's the zero trust model. So don't trust anything, can always verify. But in some instances, those smaller businesses go for ease of access and leave some of these things open with the viewpoint of, well, you know, we're a small business, we won't get attacked. Yeah, there's two things wrong there. One is you are a target. Even if the cyber criminal only demands $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 from you, but also you may be a target to get to somebody bigger. Yeah, if you look at large-scale cyber attacks, they often involve a third party or access via a third party, because cyber criminals will see that as the weak spot to get to a larger vendor.
ESET is a software company specializing in cybersecurity. I've been in conversation with Tony Anscombe. Thank you very much indeed, Tony.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, one of South Africa's most visible infrastructure successes hasn't come from government. It's been driven by the private sector. Discovery Insure's Pothole Patrol has now repaired more than 250,000 potholes, helping reduce vehicle damage and road accidents. It really is a case study in public-private cooperation. But my question, is this a sustainable service delivery or just a corporate triage in a failing system? And what happens if the goodwill runs out? I'm in conversation now with Precious Nduli, who's Chief Commercial Officer at Discovery Insure. Precious, a very warm welcome to you. And do you think it's the new norm now that corporate South Africa is responsible for fixing basic public infrastructure that the state has failed to maintain?
Hi, Jeremy. Thanks for having me. So firstly, just to correct, we fixed over 280,000. In fact, the number is now closer to 289,000 potholes. In terms of your question, I think it's particularly important for us to say this is a public-private partnership. So we are a partnership with the City of Johannesburg and the Johannesburg Road Agency. And importantly, it actually helps our business. So fundamentally, we started Pothole Patrol because we saw that there was an increase in number of claims, because obviously we're an insurer. And we saw there was an increase in number of claims that are related to potholes. And we decided that we wanted to do something about it, aligned with our core value of being a force for social good. So we don't see it as kind of bailing out the government. We see it as core to our business model as well. And we think definitely we want to encourage the private sector where they can play a role, they should.
How difficult was the initiative to set up at the get-go?
To be honest, it was, we work very well with the Johannesburg Road Agency and the City of Johannesburg. So actually, it was very good. We're actually, even through several, we've had several changes in terms of mayors, but we have always had very good relations with the city.
Are you concerned, though, that the success that you've outlined, and it is laudable, is maybe enabling government complacency rather than driving systemic reform?
So actually, I think it's encouraging the government to also do their part. Just during the period that we've had the Pothole Patrol, so we launched in May 2021. At the time, I think Fikile Mbalula was the Minister of Transport. At the time, he also announced an initiative by the government inspired by the Pothole Patrol. He also announced an initiative that aimed to also fix potholes. So I think it actually is inspirational for the city, for government in general, but also for other corporates. And that's how we look at it. And that's the role that we see ourselves in that, you know, the challenges we face as South Africa are immense. Everyone needs to play a role. And we rather see ourselves as inspirational for private sector and for public sector, rather than saying it enables the government to be complacent.
But I guess the question does remain, though, should insurers be in the business of service delivery?
So, I mean, look, at the end of the day, insurers are in the business of risk management. And that's what we try to do. And if we can use our resources, our private sector resources, to enable that, then again, it aligns with our mandate from a business perspective, but also from a social perspective, because I think it is important that even private sector, we need to have the social license to operate. And that's how we see ourselves. I mean, customers are more inclined to support businesses that actually play a positive role in society. So it is important for all corporates to actually contribute as part of their business.
Well, in that respect then, transparency is important, but it's also about the relationship that you have with the entity. So you talk about cooperation with the City of Johannesburg. How transparent is that, and who decides where to fix and when?
I mean, the relationship is very transparent. So we are literally in conversation with the leadership, as well as operationally with the teams. I mean, it is important to say the Pothole Patrol has a specific mandate. So we meant to fix kind of the smaller potholes, so 1 square meter and 3 centimeters deep, or not deeper than 3 centimeters. And anything bigger, we actually refer to the JRA. Or Johannesburg Water, if it's a water system. So we work in collaboration just because of that, in a sort of practical sense. And in terms of who determines which potholes to fix, so we have two ways. I mean, we still run very much, obviously, as Discovery, we are very much in control of the Pothole Patrol. So there are two ways in which we determine where to fix. So firstly, it's a function of, we have telematics data that tells us which roads have the highest volumes of vehicles. And we try and address those high volume, high risk roads. The second way is that we have an app where anyone can log in, not just our customers, anyone can log in and log a pothole. So that's really how we determine where to fix. But as I said, we are in constant communication with the JRA, just because some we have to refer to them because of size, or if it's a deeper problem like a waterlog problem. So we're in constant communication in that sense, but we determine where to go.
And Precious, you did mention at the start of this conversation that all of this does also serve a commercial purpose. Have you got empirical data at this point that leads to evidence of a reduction in claims and also, I guess, improving risk pools?
Yes, for sure. I mean, we've seen about a 26% reduction in claims since we launched the Pothole Patrol. I mean, we'll issue out a release, I think, this week as well. We'll see over 40 million in savings from a claims perspective. So as we said, it definitely has a commercial value. There's also branding value from a kind of just general marketing perspective as well. So as we said, that's why we say this initiative is important to us, because firstly, it aligns with our purpose of creating a nation of great drivers, because that's who we are at the core of us. I mean, Discovery Insure, as you know, we launched at the heart of Discovery Insure is the Vitality Drive program. And this is just an extension of that primarily. And that's why we want, we think there's absolutely a commercial value in addition to being a force for good, because it helps not only our clients, but other insurers as well, because we help, you know, prevent accidents in general.
Just a final one. Would Discovery walk away if the reputational value declined? And if that were to happen, what would happen to our roads?
Sure. I mean, look, we assess these things on an annual basis. We have a few initiatives, as you know, in the kind of social space. And we do assess them across, are we making a difference from a risk perspective? And what does it mean from a reputational perspective? So we continually assess it. Right now, as things stand, we have no reason to walk away. We are committed to the Pothole Patrol. We have a good working relationship with the government and the city of Johannesburg. So as things stand, we have no reason to walk away.
Precious Nduli, thank you very much indeed. Chief Commercial Officer, Discovery Insure. I appreciate your time. And that's our program for today. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.